Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We will be here for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like us to comment, or would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, gents.
We are just about out of spring shortly. Well, no, I guess June.
Yeah, June.
June, yeah.
June 21st-ish.
But
yes,
the weather should be starting to warm up, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to bring a lot of other things into play. And one of the biggest things in gardening news that I heard this week was the HLB quarantine has been expanded in San Diego County. Now it includes parts of Paula and Palma Valley. Both areas are huge in citrus production. So it'll be interesting to see what the ramifications are for that. I know there's a couple of big nurseries up there too,
mm-hmm,
which
sure.
if they fall into the quarantine, we're going to be in a world of hurt trying to keep citrus in stock. So if you've been thinking about buying some citrus, I would seriously hasten your consideration of that, because I just don't know how long it's going to go.
That quarantine zone that you just mentioned goes from the south side of the north part of Escondido, but the south side of that boundary is at the northern part of Escondido up to Pella, as you mentioned, and then all the way across to Oceanside, down on the coast and back over. So it's a big zone for us.
Yeah. And if you look at the quarantine zone up in the Los Angeles area,
it's massive.
Oh,
it's
my
massive.
Word. It is huge.
From Laguna Niguel up.
Right? Yeah. And east to Riverside County.
Yep.
I mean, it's a massive, massive area. So.
But I think you're right, Ken. If people are considering doing some citrus, by the way, we had such a good citrus class.
At
the nursery.
Yeah.
Man, there wasn't a place to park in the parking lot. I was patting myself on the back all the way home.
I had to park across the street. So.
It was a great class. And one of the things I was stressing is this is the time to get citrus in the ground. And the Poway Nursery has such a great selection. Now, I have been a fan of finger limes forever. There are red finger limes here.
Yeah.
Yes,
so people, you need to get out here, buy these red finger limes, because with the quarantine getting bad, sourcing getting bad, I would buy anything that looks promising right now. Honest to goodness. There were some very nice Chandler pomelos. I would just buy up any citrus that you might think you're wanting to have in the garden in the next year or two or three. I'd buy them now and get them in the ground.
Yeah. It doesn't hurt. And they're all in bloom right now, where most of them are in bloom. My orange trees at home are just covered with flowers right now. They've got a bunch of new spring growth coming out on them. They look absolutely fantastic. With the weather warming up though, and all that new green growth coming out, you've got to keep your eye open for the citrus leaf miner.
Mm-hmm.
One of the easier ways to do that is to use the traps, and you'll see them when they start becoming active again. They'll get caught in the traps, and that's your clue to start on a spraying schedule with spinosad to keep them under control, because that's really the only
that's organic that will help reduce the populations.
But I don't even know.
Zintite.
I don't even know if the bioadvanced systemic for citrus is available anymore. I don't think it is.
No, they took
since January 1st.
Right. Yeah.
They took imidacloprid off.
I thought so. I didn't think they could substitute, or I didn't think they would substitute the acephate in that for it. So, yeah. So the only thing that's going to control it is the spinosad, and you need something like that because it will actually penetrate the leaf. That's where the bugs are, is they're actually inside the leaf. and protected by it.
That said, you still can reduce populations just with a holistic spraying approach, mm-hmm. whether using horticultural oil or insecticidal soap will take That's care true. Of the moth if the moth is anywhere on the plant.
Yeah.
It won't kill the citrus leaf miter larva that's in between the leaves that you were just addressing.
And when we say moth, we're not talking about big moths.
Oh, no.
These things are, they're tiny. They're about the size of a...
Like a white fly. Maybe a little smaller than a white fly.
A little smaller than a white fly. But they can cause some incredible damage. Mm-hmm. If you do see some of the damage on them, on your citrus, just pruning or pinching those affected parts off after you spray or prior to spraying, that will help control it as well. And the new growth should come out. New growth should come out clean once you start using the spinosad on it, because it will offer some systemic protection for them.
One of the things that people frequently do, though, that is really erroneous is that they'll strip all the leaves off their citrus tree, or they prune them back super hard. And I just go, don't do that.
No.
No, it doesn't do anything to help. And then you get a flush of new green growth that's going to actually become potentially infected, unless you're dealing with the pest. Mm-hmm. And then people over prune their citrus, and then they'll get sun scald, and their bark splits. And so it just ends up with this downward vortex of decline. And so if your leaves do go infected, you know, they're still producing food.
It's
so
cosmetic.
It's cosmetic really only. Yeah, so I'd leave really them is. On, but really do use the spinosad, put the traps out and get on top of it.
I like to equate it to dirty solar panels. Mm-hmm. You know, those leaves are still producing mm-hmm. energy for the plant, albeit not at the same rate that they would be were they not deformed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, if you do get the leaf miner, and you see the foliage starting to curl and you spray, usually a good feeding, if it's not too close between fertilizing intervals, it'll push out a lot of new growth, and the new growth will just come out and grow completely over the damaged growth, and you're not going to have any problems. So that's, keep your eyes open for that. And then also the other, you know, just citrus in general, the pests, watch out for aphids, whitefly. Scale is probably the most insidious pest that
can scale is my bane right now. Mm-hmm. I'll be spraying this weekend.
Yeah, but fortunately it's relatively easy to control. The horticultural oil will control just about everything mm-hmm. except for the leaf miner if it's already established in the plant.
Yeah, once it hatches and starts mining. Yeah.
And we've mentioned this before, we typically recommend just preventative spraying of the horticultural oil 3-4 times a year, because it'll get rid of stuff that you don't even realize that you have. And because it's not a poison, technically, you can spray it. You could spray the tree and then put the hose away and come back and pick any fruit that's on it, because it suffocates the insects rather than poisoning the insects. So
just one caveat, though, don't do that during warm weather, because you can burn your plants. So right, we're on the cusp of warm weather. So I'd say, if possible, get some horticultural oil spraying in on your citrus as soon as possible, because it's
before
still
it
cool enough. But once it's too hot, don't do it. But I can espouse my treatment that I like to affectionately call the Merlot treatment. You could call it the Cabernet treatment or just the Cerveza method. And that is, you get the Bug Blaster nozzle, which I think mm-hmm. Walter Anderson's Nursery is the only place that has these available now, to put a Bug Blaster nozzle on a wand and go out with your favorite beverage in the cool of the evening and just blast water onto your tree. And that'll knock the scale off. It'll knock off 80% at least of the woolly whitefly, woolly aphid and all that. And it cleans the leaves off, keeps the dust off, so spider mites aren't a problem. So just, it's amazing what water will do if you're efficient use of it.
I want to add one more caveat to your oil caveat. So mm-hmm. a second caveat, if I may. Make sure the plants are well hydrated before you spray. So if it's been a particularly, you know, a dry period of time, you haven't watered in a while, don't go out and spray until that mm-hmm. tree is well hydrated.
That's a good rule of thumb for any kind of spraying.
Yeah. True.
Don't spray dry plants. Make sure. And when we say water the plants before, we don't mean water the plant and then hook the sprayer up and immediately spray. Give it a chance to soak up some of that water. It takes mm-hmm. a little while for the root system to pull that water up into the plant. But that's a very good rule of thumb. Another good rule of thumb
when
you're spraying.
There's a third.
There's a third. Okay. There's a third caveat
number three.
spray early in the morning or late in the evening when bees are not active. Because even though horticultural oil is not a poison, if you spray enough of it on bees, you will kill the bees. So just, but it, the, from a residual standpoint, it's not going to do anything to the bees. But you just don't want to spray it on them. So hence you spray early in the morning or late in the evening when the bees are not active.
I will challenge you. You have to get up really, really early to, particularly in the warmer months, to not spray when there are bees active. Well, I go out there at 6:30 in the morning with a cup of coffee and the bees are all over the plants. So
yeah.
I prefer to spray in the evening as the sun is starting to go down and the bees have gone home.
They go to bed a little earlier.
They do.
Yeah.
Although I'm catching up to them.
Or the other option, if you can do it, is don't spray when the plants when the plant has flowers on it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you don't have to worry about the bees at all.
Also true.
Yeah. You know, speaking of pest control, we were talking before we came on the air about vegetable gardening and watching out for pests in vegetable gardening. And there again, like you said, a strong stream of water will control a lot of things. So if you're watering by hand with a hose stuff off. You can keep a lot of it under control. Although George, you had mentioned as far as the brassicas and things like that, water is probably not going to be the only thing you need to use to keep stuff under control.
When I use water on the broccoli or the cabbages and such, when you put a jet stream on it, you watch like a milky gray film form on the water that's pooling underneath the plants. And those are all aphids that are just coming out with it. And
it looks like an oil film.
Odd, exactly. Yeah. And it works well to help reduce populations. It's not a panacea. It is a mitigating step, I think, for most of your Brassicaceae. It takes a lot of effort to keep them clean.
Yeah. They're real easy for things to hide in, just by the nature of their growth habit. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We were talking about vegetable gardening before the break. And if you haven't done it yet, there's still plenty of time to get a vegetable garden put in. As a matter of fact, I put in put in a couple of tomatoes. I don't grow too many tomatoes anymore, just maybe two or three plants. But I did plant the Amish deer tongue lettuce that we had talked about, one of the 15 heirlooms that we need to start growing again, and the tennis ball lettuce. So I'm curious to see how those are going to go. And I had mentioned to you while we were off the air, George, with Thomas Jefferson saying to plant a thimble full of lettuce seed.
From February to September. Every week.
A thimble full of lettuce seed is a lot of lettuce seed.
Several crates. My gosh.
I was just trying to picture that, how much space that would take up, and to keep doing it every month for that long. That's a
weekly.
He must have really liked lettuce.
Well, he also was feeding a large, you know, workforce.
Well, that's true.
As well.
Didn't he start Tender Greens too? One of these salad bar restaurants.
Yeah. He may have.
Well, I think we mentioned this last week. John, you've been up at the house recently and saw the garden. We have so much lettuce in our garden right now, and we didn't plant any of it. It's all volunteer because I let a couple of things go to seed. They blew over, and they are just, it's incredibly productive. But they're also in the way of the summer garden, so we're trying to eat through it so we can plant our summer garden.
Try to work your way through it. So this is a great time. Any of the summer crops can go in now. You have plenty of time to plant them from seed if you want to plant them from seed. One of the ones that I usually recommend that you plant from seed rather than buying it in six packs because it just doesn't make any sense is corn. Corn's very easy to grow from seed, and you get far more corn in a packet of corn seed than you do in a six pack of vegetables. Mm-hmm. And you're buying it in the six pack, you're only gaining maybe 3 weeks, something like that on the crop. But yeah, if you want to plant corn, buy it in seed and grow it from seed. The other thing about corn too is when you plant it, you want to plant it in blocks. You don't want to plant it just in single rows, because you've got to get the pollen to move between them, and you get much better pollination if you plant it in a block form rather than just a single row or a couple of single plants here and there. And you can tell when you don't get good pollination on corn, when you pull the husk off of it, you'll just have intermittent gaps in the ear where there are no kernels, because each one of those silks goes down and forms a seed. So you can see where they did and did not get pollinated. But real easy to grow. I grew some for the first time in a long time. I think it was 2 years ago, and I had a lot of ears set, but the rats got most of them. I would go out, and there just was nothing left of them.
We didn't have a problem with our corn patch with rats the last couple of years, but we have had a problem in the initial planting with rabbits. So whenever we plant the corn, we put a little chicken wire fence around it just until they get tall enough.
The rabbit's not going to cut it down.
And if I may, a caveat to the one plant you should start from seed and not purchase, radishes is another one. I'm saddened when I see people buy radishes that are started. It's 28 days, depending on the variety, 24, 28, 32 days from seed to eating. But it's also such a joy, especially for kids. It's one of the best plants, I think, to introduce children into growing. Whether they like them or not is a different story, but because they have the satisfaction of planting and harvesting something with a very short attention span, like the rest of us.
They germinate very quickly.
Right.
Within a matter of days, you'll start to see them growing. As a matter of fact, I think at the kids program at the fairgrounds, they used to, when they would have the vegetable growing contest, that's what they would grow was radishes. Rich would have the kids plant radishes because they grow quickly. They're easy. And a packet of radish seeds will go a long way.
I think one of the things that people need to bear in mind when we're talking home vegetable gardens too, is that I'd say 90% of people are always behind the curve, because when they start thinking, gee, I'd really like to grow some pumpkins about September.
Yeah.
It's
Halloween's coming.
Yeah. So if you're thinking Halloween pumpkins and maybe pumpkins for pie for Thanksgiving, you know when you need to be doing that? Like in the next couple of 3 weeks. My friend Trish Watlington at Two Forks Farm was posting this week. She's planting out her summer gardens now. Yeah. So folks, you need to be thinking months ahead of what you think, because by the time you're getting to the end of summer and you're thinking, I'd love some watermelons from the garden, you've missed that. So you can't fix the barn door once the horse has left. So you're needing to start your winter garden.
You can fix it, but you have to buy a new horse.
But you need a new horse because the horse left. You're planning out your winter garden starting in September is when I'm starting some stuff from seed. And so conversely, summer garden, it's now, folks. It doesn't seem like it would be the right time, but it is.
The other thing to keep in mind too, especially with some of the squash, pumpkins, watermelons, you need space.
You do.
You need to give them room to grow. It's not something that lends itself to growing, and unfortunately, in a container garden, because the vines need a place to run. Now, zucchini you could grow in a container because it's not
you
really
you can do bush
not,
varieties.
Yeah, it's not really a. Not really vining.
Yeah, the vining ones, such as the watermelon, pumpkins, butternut squash. We plant those under all of our fruit trees. Irrigation underneath there. There's a lot of mulch. There's shade to get them started, and they just run, and it works really well.
One of my favorite squash, Lakota, which is
that's a good one.
Gorgeous, a two-tone green and orange, delicious flavor, very hearty. It's an old variety that the Native Americans grew, and I think it's through Botanical Interest Seed, if I remember correctly, but that thing had vines that went 30 to 40 feet from the base. I mean, literally it was in the whole yard. So you have to really study well, look at your seed packets and see how big the plants are going to get. Because you're right. We don't think about, you know, we don't live on farms anymore. You know, we have McMansions and the tiny little raised beds. And then we put in something like that. And it is like a jungle vine taking over a Mayan ruin, you know?
Yeah, they will grow very quickly and very, very large. You know, as far as productivity is concerned, the zucchinis are tough to, that's a tough one to beat. I mean, they typically will produce almost more, one or two plants will produce more than a lot of people would normally eat, normally consume. The other thing with zucchini too is once the fruit sets, you got to keep an eye on it because, okay, I need to harvest that in a day or so. And you go out 4 days later and you've got a baseball bat laying there on the ground. So, but even the bigger ones, if they get out of, if you let them get too big, which we did a few years ago, just by accident, we didn't harvest the fruit in time. Just slice them up, douse them with some olive oil and throw them on the grill. And I mean, grilled zucchini
is
pretty darn good.
It's better than most ways of cooking zucchini, I think. Yeah. I love it grilled or zucchini bread. That's quite tasty.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Yeah. That's another one that you were
talking about, you know, planting in time. Don't think about pumpkins in September because the next month is October. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we tend not to do real well is succession planting. You know, Farmer Roy talked about that when he was here. You put in some radishes as an example that we just spoke of, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And then 28 days later, you have a big bunch, you harvest them and you're done.
And you have no more.
And you have no more, as opposed to putting some in and, you know, a week, 2 weeks later, going back to the Thomas Jefferson thing, right? Mm-hmm. You plant every week a quantity of seed so that you always have stuff coming during the growing season for that particular crop. I'm not that good at it either, but it is something just because I'm pretty lazy.
Yeah.
It's something we can aspire to.
There we go. Yeah. We will aspire to that.
And, you know, like with Farmer Roy, he typically grows, if I'm not mistaken, he grows determinate varieties of tomatoes.
Mostly,
determinate. Yeah. And so they come in, they grow up, they produce their crop, and then he pulls the whole thing out and has another crop already ready to go. Because the initial crop is where the biggest is your biggest harvest.
He doesn't use cages, which I love. He does, we call it the Florida weave, right. You know, where you kind of weave them between poles.
Tomato post, and then he just figurates the ropes around them.
He is a tomato genius.
He is.
You know,
and he's going to join us sometime in May.
Oh, good.
To do on the radio, to talk a little bit about summer gardening with keeping your plants alive during the summer when we have the intense heat here, particularly tomatoes.
Yeah, they do like water.
They like water and sometimes a little shade, which we will touch on in the future.
Even though they do like water, they are pretty forgiving. I mean, I grow tomatoes in containers on my pool deck, so they're in full sun on concrete all day long. And if I forget to water them on a regular basis, they'll start to wilt a little bit, but you really have to withhold the water from them for a long, long time to kill them. It doesn't do them any good, but they are a very forgiving.
They're resilient.
Plant. Yeah, they're very, very resilient. So that's a good thing when you're growing tomatoes. And you know, and if you don't have a lot of space, grow a patio tomato.
Mm-hmm.
Just a relatively short growing tomato produces probably about fruit that's a little bit smaller than a tennis ball, I would say. But they're upright. They don't require staking or cages or anything. Real easy to grow. That's one. And then there was another one that was a smaller tomato. I can't remember which one it is. Oh, and if you just want sheer volume, grow a cherry tomato.
Any of the cherries
or the pear tomatoes will give you tremendous amounts of fruit.
Yeah. I think we touched on one of those before, like the Sweet 100.
Sweet 100, Sun Gold.
Yeah. Rapunzel. Mm-hmm. Those are all fun, the way that they grow on that, you know, like Rapunzel's hair.
There's also one that I've never seen it in color packs, but really, truly worth getting. And that is Principe de Borghese. And you can get it from some specialty houses, different seed houses. But it is the one that is favored in Italy for doing sun-dried tomatoes.
Oh.
And it is the best. I've raised them from seed before, and it's a very, very much a determinant, but it's covered with fruit, and they're very meaty, not much seed, and not juicy, but man, made into
sun-dried.
Oh, what a great tomato.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. And we were talking about tomatoes and just growing tomatoes in general. But one of the things, a couple of things you need to watch out for, especially when we have cooler, damp weather, is blight and black spot. Or it'll show
all
up.
All kinds of fungal things.
Relatively easy to control. A lot of them will grow out of it. For the most part, as the weather starts to warm up and dry out, you can control some of the early blight and things like that with copper spray. Use that.
I think copper is the number one preferred fungicide, organic, for a lot of the tomato diseases.
Yeah, I think Daconil, you can use
I'm
Daconil
sure it will, too, because I know John's a fan of Daconil.
Yeah. I like it a lot.
Yeah, that's another one that you can use. And then as far as insects are concerned, the most damaging one is probably going to be the tomato hornworm, and you need to really keep an eye on your plants for that. For one thing, they're very hard to spot. Even when they're the size of your finger, they're hard to spot. But if you start seeing foliage disappear on your plant, you probably have tomato hornworms on there, and you need to get them under control, or they will decimate your plants.
And the brown poops.
That's what I was going to say.
Often
you'll see the droppings and look above that spot on the plant, and you will typically find them.
Yeah. And they're relatively easy to control. If they're big, you can just, if you want to, you can pick them off and dispatch them. Or BT works very, very well. Right. And it's an organic control. It's a microbial insecticide. And spinosad will work well against them.
The downside to the spinosad, and I'm a fan, I use it a lot, is that it has a lot more restrictions on how soon you can harvest, how many times you can spray. Where the BT, I can spray it today and harvest tomorrow and be fine. So
if you have spinosad, you can use it,
but be cautious and read the label.
Yeah. Some of the stuff on spinosad is kind of, I don't understand it because some things it's 1 or 2 days, but then
some are 14 and asparagus is 60.
Yes. Yeah. Right. I'm not sure what the reason is for that.
Then again, I'm conflicted on the tomato hornworms because they make the coolest moth.
That part's true.
The sphinx moth that we see in the summertime, sometimes at night, and it's like the size of a hummingbird. They're so cool. Yeah. And so part of me says, I don't want to have them eat my tomato plants. On the other hand, I go, what an incredible thing to see in the summer on an evening to see a sphinx moth fly by. So I don't know.
So here's the plan. You grow some old tomatoes that you have in the house. Take those seeds, go put them somewhere where you're going to have some water and move them to that.
There you go.
That way they can survive. Or any other Solanaceae.
Like trap plants.
Like trap plants, yes. You know, I'm sorry. That was going to say, you know, the potato vine, the Solanaceae, the purple flower or the tree? At my other house, years ago, I walked past it one day and it looked horrible. It had a couple leaves. And I thought, oh my goodness, did the water go off? Why is this looking so poorly? And I was going up on the hill. And when I came back, I was at a different angle and I saw tomato hornworms. It's in the Solanaceae family. Mm-hmm. It was covered. I remembered it vividly. There were 17 of them.
Oh my
God. It was a big tree. I mean, it's a shrub, you know, it was 10, 12 feet tall. And I picked 17 tomato hornworms off, threw them in the middle of the yard, and then later on the birds were flying around. But it was, it introduced me to all of the plants that are in the Solanaceae family.
Well, and tangentially, you know, I found my first red-humped caterpillar this week on a Cercis forest pansy. And last year, I think, and the year before, were incredibly bad years for red hump caterpillars. In fact, I hadn't seen them in years. And then last year, people would have their trees literally defoliated in a day or two. Mm-hmm. There would be red humped caterpillars by the thousands, and they were stripping every leaf off of every tree. So I would be looking now, you know, we're kind of on that subject, BT and caterpillars and destruction. I would just be inspecting my cerces on a regular basis
and
right now.
Liquid ambers they like.
And liquid ambers too.
So oh, that's
and,
true.
And a number of fruit trees, I can't recall if it was it was a plum. They were all over my plum trees.
Yeah, sometimes on prunus, they will be there too. Yep. So be careful. I would just inspect probably on a weekly basis because it's shocking how quickly those things can defoliate a tree.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's talking about caterpillar damage. Back in Key West, they have a butterfly conservatory back there, which is, if you're ever in Key West, and I highly recommend you go there, it's an absolutely fantastic place. The butterfly conservatory in Key West is amazing. It is absolutely incredible. And it's the main part of the conservatory is this big steel and glass Victorian style greenhouse that is just fully landscaped with this lush tropical landscape. And there's butterflies from all over the world flying around through the space. But all of the plants are absolutely perfect. They're not eaten at all. Hmm. And we were talking to one of the docents when we were back there. And they said how they manage that is that all of the plants that are inside the greenhouse in the conservatory, none of them are host plants for any of the butterflies that they have in there. Hmm. So they're, a lot of them are blooming, and then they do have feeding stations too, where they'll put out slices of citrus and fruit and things like that. But the butterflies will land and feed on these plants, but because it's not a host plant, they won't lay their eggs.
Hmm.
So they never have a problem with it. And pretty much all of the butterflies that are in the conservatory are imported in as chrysalis. And then they have a hatching room where they let them all hatch, and then they release them out into the conservatory. And then the other thing that they do too, which is kind of neat, something that we've had to do every time we take our son Blake there, the dead butterflies, when they reach the end of their life, they collect them out of the conservatory, and then they preserve them and they mount them in plexiglass cases. I don't even know how many different ones Blake has now, but every time we would go there, he had to get a butterfly. But it's an absolutely wonderful place. And one of the coolest things that they have there, and you have to look for them, but you can find them. They have Atlas moths.
Wow.
Which are enormous. Mm-hmm. The wingspan on them is probably between six and eight inches across, and then they have the big swallowtails on their wings. Absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
Wow.
Insects. And they typically are not flying around. They're usually sedentary on the trunk of a tree, kind of hidden away. But if you look for them in there, you'll find them, and they're just absolutely beautiful. Beautiful insects.
What struck me was you'd mentioned that they were imported. And I remember several weeks back, one of the segments we talked about licensing and permits for monarchs.
For monarchs.
And right. So there is something
people
out there.
People releasing them for weddings and things. I had no idea.
I had no idea that there was a whole, I assume there had to be some kind of business, because there are lots of butterflies that are, you can purchase for things like the conservatory, but I didn't realize there was such a permitting process that was associated with it.
Oh, it's very, very highly controlled.
Highly regulated.
Yeah,
yes.
Highly regulated. Yeah. The facilities all have to be USDA inspected because they don't want invasive species getting out. And as beautiful as some butterflies are,
the larvae aren't quite as beautiful.
Can be a little bit problematic. So it's very, very tightly controlled. And I think, well, they did have a butterfly, the hidden jungle up at the wild animal
Safari
park, which I think. They recently reopened on a temporary basis. When that first opened, that was pretty amazing what they had going on up there. And as neat as the butterflies were in there, my favorite thing was the leaf cutter ants.
Those are so cool.
It was really, they'd have these long vines coming down out of the trees, and there'd just be this trail of ants running up it, and they each had big chunk of leaf stuck in its jaws. Though that was really interesting. But I don't know if it just got to be too difficult to manage or what, but I think it's very seasonal now when the hidden jungle is open. It's not open all year round like it used to be when it was originally put in.
On an orchid collecting trip in Venezuela once, I'd never seen ants this big, but the natives, what they would do, if you're injured in a battle, they don't have stitches. Obviously, they're not calling the doctor and stitching up. So they would, if they had a very deep cut, they would have these ants with huge mandibles and heads. Mm-hmm. They'd have the ant bite the two sides of the wound, and it would pinch it closed, and then they'd cut the head off.
Oh, jeez.
So they would have these heads of ants with this wound sealed up. So when I think about insects, we don't even begin to know what it's like to have some gargantuan, scary insects. We worry about our Argentine ants, and then you go to the jungle in Venezuela, and that's some serious ants there.
Yeah, we're pretty fortunate when it comes to pests like that. We don't have to deal with it nearly as much as you do down in tropical areas.
We do have some of our own significant pests, though. I mean,
we do.
I'm just thinking of the Hunta virus and from mice and deer mice droppings. And Gene Hackman passed away from it, and there were three more cases recently in California. So it is a concern, and that's something that people really don't think about. They open up a closet outside or something in their shed or the garage, and there's some droppings, and they just sweep it up, and that virus can be lingering in there. We spent a good segment talking about the citrus leaf miner. Mm-hmm. That insect, that's a pest, and it really makes trees look horrible. Mm-hmm. And that didn't exist in California till the late 1990s.
Yeah.
Right. And now it's everywhere. So we have our own little pests. Maybe they're not as big and glamorous as those others, but we have a lot of pests.
Well, and another pest that doesn't seem to be as big of a problem as it did when I was a kid is fleas.
True.
In general.
Mm-hmm. And mentioned why.
Yeah. I was talking to Jamie Ogle, who owns Lloyd Pest Control here in San Diego. And he said that it was one of the species of ants that was brought in. The ants feed off of flea larvae.
Yeah, flea larvae.
So you have the ants in your yard. They take care of the majority of the fleas. You still see it every once in a while. But man, I remember we used to bug bomb the house.
Oh yes, we did too.
Keep them under control.
You'd wear white socks and you'd walk through the house and you'd see it look like somebody sprinkled pepper all over your socks.
Yes, yeah.
And they're working their way through and they're going to bite your legs. Yeah. I hated it.
Yeah.
No, you know, historically speaking, one of the things, I was quite a historian with state parks eons ago, but all of the early pioneers that came, the first school teacher at Mason Street Schoolhouse describes in her diary how horrendous the fleas were here. She said you would be eaten alive by fleas. You literally would walk anywhere. It's all dirt, of course, back then. And you would think, how many pets could there have been? So these are just extant in this biome here.
Yeah.
And she said that the fleas were horrendous. And in fact, at Camp Pendleton, it is named Rancho de las Pulgas, which means Ranch of the Fleas.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back with more right after this. And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. John, I noticed the other day that you had made a post on your Facebook page about one vine that I think is way underutilized in landscaping in San Diego, and is Petrea.
Yes.
Volubilis. Volubilis.
Yes.
Beautiful purple flower. Relatively easy to grow. Doesn't get out of hand. It's a little woodier than some of the other vines. But a really, really nice plant. We try to keep them in stock when we can find them, but it's just not one that you just don't see it that
it's
much.
It's very hard to find.
Yeah.
And you'll see it every few years. I tell people frequently, just like here where I saw honest to goodness when we had the red finger limes here at the nursery. Mm-hmm. I've told people, take this home today because you may never see one of these again.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just, there are certain things in the nursery business that if you see it, buy it. Another one, I was at Barrels and Branches recently. And there was Jasminum Humulae, which...
Oh, I saw that too.
Yeah, I haven't seen that in 20 years, maybe 25 years. And there were two plants. And I posted and said, I don't have a place for this, but somebody make this your baby and you give it a forever home. And so that is a plant. Anytime you would see Pitrea volubilis, I would buy it. And the picture I posted is in, you know, we do a lot of maintenance all over town. Torrey Pines Mesa, Carmel Valley, I find to be one of the most challenging areas to grow anything because the soil is the worst. The worst. There is no soil. It's sandstone, white sandstone, doesn't drain well, or it drains too fast. But here's this vine in one of the most challenging gardens we maintain, and it just looked like $1 million.
And that's called a Queen's Wreath, right?
Is it Queen's Wreath is one of the common names. Sometimes they call it sandpaper vine, too.
Right.
And it looks a little bit like a wisteria, but then on the other hand, not. And it's what's beautiful about it is the way that the inflorescence of the flowers is carried. They are so graceful. They just arch out, and it's like shooting stars on this little vine. And I think it's just one of the prettiest things I've ever seen. And my friend Tom Pierre Grossi posted on my Instagram. Tom, by the way, marvelous plantsman, used to be in San Diego and Vista. Now he's in Hawaii and has Vintage Green Farms on the Big Island. And he said, do you know about the large one? And I went, no. So there's even a larger form. So again, folks, where we source stuff, it's not easy. So I, you know, go to your local independent nursery. Are you ever going to see one of these things at Home Depot? No.
Probably not.
At Lowe's? Yeah. No. And so keep your wholesalers alive by buying their plants. Keep your local independent nurseries going by being good patrons. I can't stress that enough.
What's the care and culture for that? Can it take full sun? Or?
It wants full sun. It'll take some shade. It also is very hardy. It seems to grow in dry soil. It takes a fair amount of water too. So it's very, very easy to grow. It looks wonderful. So if you ever find one, buy it. I would say I wouldn't even think about it twice.
Yeah, it's a neat plant. You know, another one that we've gotten every once in a while, we'll find one of our growers will have it, is Cumbratum.
Yeah.
Fruticosum. Uh-huh. Really, really interesting plant. The way that the flower forms, the flower is almost the closest thing that I could describe it looking like is a hairbrush.
Mm-hmm.
The way that it grows. Really, really neat plant. But that's another one that it's very unusual. If you spot it, you should grab it because you just never know when you're going to see it again. But that's one of the problems that we face as an industry is some of the nurseries that grew that kind of stuff aren't around anymore.
Yeah.
And the biggest loss that we're going to be facing is going to be San Marcos growers.
Right.
And
right.
They are going to be gone next year. As a matter of fact, I don't even know if they're still coming down here.
They are, but it just big lots. And in fact, they're selling off parent plants, stock plants and things right now.
Yeah.
Too.
They're unloading just liquidating. Everything. Just liquidating. But they're going to disappear. Summer Wholesale Nursery.
Oh, gosh. And Templeton.
Disappeared. Yeah.
That was so good. Yeah.
Steve Summer used to grow just some of the most amazing stuff.
And oh, gosh. Remember the Thunderhead or Thundercloud Japanese black pines? He was the only guy my gosh. They were just.
Yeah.
I put more of those in gardens.
Yeah.
Well, San Marcos Growers is going to be an impact just research.
Yeah.
Because their website, if they said they're going to try to keep it going, but their website is incredibly robust with a lot of useful information.
It really is.
The other source of, frankly, very, very good plant material. I was at Point Loma's store this week too, and I recognized a lot of anthuriums of various species. Those are coming from my dear friend. Hello, Harry. Harry Phillips. And Harry is one of the best growers of the rare, the unusual, the oddity, and fantastic bromeliads, orchids, things like this, anthuriums that he raises in his garden up in Leucadia. And so, gosh, you just have no idea how rare some of these things are that are sitting on the shelves at the nursery, and you need to buy them.
Yeah. Yeah. There is some neat stuff out there. You know what? One of the nurseries that's disappeared from San Diego that I used to love going to was Stallings. Stallings Ranch Nursery and Insignia's, they always had unusual stuff and things you couldn't find anywhere else. And and the manager, the longtime manager at Stallings, Dale Kolakowski, actually came to work for us when Stallings shut down. Yeah, he worked for us for a number of years. Really, really knowledgeable plantsman. Mm-hmm. He knew if I got stumped by something that I didn't know what it was, I could always turn to Dale and he would know it. And the other thing that he was really good at, because they grew a lot of their own stuff, he was outstanding at propagation.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the tips and tricks to make stuff work that was very difficult to grow.
Whenever I see people post and they say, I want to know how to propagate this leucodendron or this leucospermum, and I say, don't do it. The growers have special greenhouses with humidity control. They're misting like every 5 minutes to keep them alive.
Bottom heat.
Else, yeah. Listen, go buy it at the nursery. And, you know, like Joe and Julie Walker up at Obra Verde, they're just the best growers in the world. You can't compete with that. And so don't. Just buy a nice plant in a 1 gallon and take it home, you know. And by the way, I found, speaking of vines, one of my favorite vines is Jasminum tortuosum. It's African twisted jasmine, South African twisted jasmine. And I saw them at the Point Loma store. I don't know if we have any here.
We do. I don't know if there's any today, but we do carry
them.
That's
such a great vine. Yes. And most people are always using Trachylospermum jasminoides, which is star jasmine, which gives you, let's be generous about it, you might get 6 weeks of bloom, maybe a month of bloom, typically May through June. But Jasminum tortuosum, which is a great, I love language in Latin, tortuosum, to torture, to twist. And, you know, that's actually where we get the word torture, is because you would be writhing and twisting in pain. And so anyway, that's an aside. But Jasminum tortuosum is one of the best plants you could put in the garden. It's glossy green leaves, blooms about 7-8 months of the year, and it's a true jasmine. So you get that. There's a difference between star jasmine and true jasmine scent. And the true jasmine scent of the tortuosum is fabulous. Do you guys have a favorite vine?
Passiflora edulis.
Passiflora are spectacular. Speaking of jasmines, I like the pink jasmine. It's a very, very short window that it's in bloom. And other than that,
and then it's really, a rat nest.
It's a rat nest.
It's funny when you said that you get a different jasmine scent. I was thinking of the pink jasmine. It's a wonderful
scent.
It's
a great scent.
For 3.5 weeks or whatever that number
for
is.
About a month.
Gone.
Yeah.
And then a rat's nest.
But that's a good one. I do like the trumpet vines.
I do too.
Distichus and was
used to be Bignonia.
Bignonia. Yeah. But the royal trumpet vine.
Oh, that's a nice one.
The purple one.
Yeah.
Bignonia Scherer, the red trump, blood red trumpet vine.
River's Eye.
Well, what about, a very popular one for us that we sell a lot of and does well in some partial shade here in the hotter areas are the Mandevillas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those, and you know, they, before the Diplodanias really hit the scene, it was just the large leaf, large flowering
form. The crinkly leaf one.
But they just never look that great.
Right.
I mean, it's a spectacular flower, interesting foliage. They're very prone to pests.
Alice DuPont vine, they used
to
call
it,
right?
Remember? That's what it was, yeah.
And what a pain to grow. They never look good. I don't care who you were, you couldn't grow them.
They were difficult.
Well, the Mandevilla is in the same family as milkweed. And so it gets the same oleander, that little orange aphid that's on the milkweed all the time. It gets those as well.
Yeah.
And you have to battle them. And I just thought about that. We have one that we just recently put in, and we put it right next to two milkweed plants. So it's going to be a plethora of orange aphids here pretty soon.
Well, and when Diplodanias first hit the market, it was red. That's all there was. And now they come in
yellow,
pinks,
whites, apricots,
apricot. There's all kinds of them. And Diplodanias are a significantly easier vine to grow. The flowers aren't as big, but they're just as spectacular. And the plants are much, much easier to grow than the standard Mandevillas were.
That's one though, it just doesn't turn me on, I'm afraid. It does not get me very excited.
Yeah. It's a tough one. Although one year we, at our exhibit at the fair, we put in a huge huge Diplodania. I didn't even know where we got it, but it was a big Diplodania, and we had a big bowl from Ganey Ceramics, and it was a blue bowl, and we put it on a pedestal, and we planted the Diplodania in that, and it spilled out over the sides, and I think we won, in addition to the whatever other awards, we got best specimen plant for the Diplodania that we had in the display.
I remember that. I may have been the judge on that even. I remember it was spectacular.
Yeah, it was a neat one. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We will be back with another hour of Garden Talk next Saturday morning. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.